be beginning in chapter 11. We've talked about the fact that the book of Job deals with facing troubles, facing problems, facing trials and tribulations, facing even death. Remember, Job's children all died. He had 10 children and lost them all in one day. So certainly his grief over that, as well as the physical condition that he was suffering from, that God had allowed Satan to afflict him with, and so many other things that were going on with him, having lost all of his physical wealth as well. Sometimes we're a little hard on Job's wife, but we have to remember that she lost all of her children that day too. And her husband lost all of her wealth, and her husband lost his health. Now that doesn't justify her behavior and the way she wanted Job to curse God and die, but it does tell us the way that most people would react when faced with that kind of trouble in their life. But Job was not most people. Job was a very special man, and God knew that, or he never would have sent these troubles to Job. He never would have allowed it to happen if he didn't know that Job could have handled these things. The amazing thing about the Bible, we know, we talked this morning and have mentioned on several other occasions, that it is all inspired by God. Because of that, every verse, every sentence, every word in the Bible is significant. God didn't just put it there to fill up pages. There's a reason for it. And sometimes as we read through some of these things, we find some of the most unusual little jewels that we never expected to find. And some of those we'll see tonight. Again, we can mark every verse because, again, it is all inspired by God. But there are certain verses that jump out at certain times. And if you read through it, different verses might jump out at you than what jumped out at me when I was looking for things. Because sometimes when we have different things on our mind, and we may read the same thing, where I might see one verse, you might see another verse that applies more to the situation that you're currently facing. But hopefully, we've picked some that will be generally of good use for all of us. We start in chapter 11 with verse number 3. Zophar the Naamathite is now speaking. He's going to try to answer Job. So far, we've had Bildad the Shuhite try to answer Job. We've had Eliphaz the Temanite try to answer Job. And now the third of his friends is going to speak up, Zophar. And Zophar thinks he has answers. Notice what he says in verse 3. Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? Zophar makes it very clear that he thinks that Job, as he has tried to defend himself before God and tried to say that he hasn't done anything to deserve this, Zophar says, Job, you're a liar. And somebody needs to make you ashamed of lying about that. You're mocking God by saying that you're righteous, by saying that you haven't done anything to deserve this. And he goes on then to explain. And he says, oh, for you've said my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. And he says, but oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee. Now remember that verse, because later on God is going to speak. And we'll see whose side God takes in this matter. Maybe you already know, but we're going to see it again anyway. But they're on opposite sides. Job saying, oh, if the Lord would come down, he would tell you, I haven't done anything to deserve this. And his friends Zophar here are saying, Job, you're a liar. You're mocking God. And how can you stand there and not be ashamed to do these things? To say these things? You know that God's punishing you because you're a sinner. And because you've done something wrong. And so he continues to wail on Job in that way through the end of the chapter. Notice in chapter 12, Job responds. We have a series, and always one of his friends will speak, and then Job will answer, and then one of his friends will speak, and then Job's going to try to answer again. And the same pattern throughout the book until close to the end. Job in chapter 12 and verse 2, we see a number of times throughout the book as Job speaks that maybe it's because of the circumstances, maybe because, you know, at some point things get so bad that you just can't do anything but laugh. And Job, maybe it's to that point. And you hear, you can almost hear in his words the sarcasm and the cutting as he responds to these so-called friends who are accusing him of any and everything under the sun. His friend here has just called him a liar and said he's mocking God. And so Job says in verse 2, "No doubt but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you." Now that might not seem like much to us, but if we really look at what he's saying, he's saying, no doubt you're the only smart people in the world, and when you die there won't be any brains left in the whole wide world. And Job cuts back at them. He's trying to give as good as he's getting from them. And he lets them know, then, in the next verse, he says, "I have understanding as well as you." He lets them know, they're not the only ones that have some knowledge and some wisdom. We have to be careful. And perhaps, and probably all of us have made this mistake at one time or another, when we're dealing with someone who's going through a trying time, of saying or doing something, even in an attempt to help, but sometimes we may say or do something that actually winds up making the situation worse. And that's kind of what Job's friends are doing here. They've come to comfort him, and they sat with him, and I think Job was probably a lot happier while they were sitting there not saying anything. Once they started talking, they weren't much comfort anymore. And that's the way we are sometimes. We want to say something, but sometimes we say the wrong thing. And, of course, we can't read other people's hearts and souls like Jesus could to know exactly what the right thing to say would be. But we do sometimes say things that wind up making the situation worse and make the person feel like, well, you just think you know it all. You don't know what I'm going through. You don't have any idea how I'm feeling. And here you come in telling me how I ought to be acting or telling me what I ought to be thinking. And you don't know. You don't know what it's like to be me. And that's true. None of us ever knows what it's like to be in that other person's shoes. We can't know that. And it's a very sad thing when we make judgments toward them and say things that even intended to help, but tell us as though we know how the problem could be solved and give the impression that we're know-it-alls. Nobody appreciates being around a know-it-all for very long. It might be very helpful if you're trying to answer some trivia questions for a grand prize and a sweepstakes, but beyond that, it's not very nice to have somebody around that always knows what you should be doing in the situation you're in. And it's difficult for us sometimes to avoid doing that. When we look at a situation, it sometimes is easier for us to think, oh, I know what I could do if I was in that situation. But it's always easier to look from the outside in and see what ought to be done. Those of you who watch sports know how much easier it is to sit and watch the TV and tell them what they should have done out there. But you weren't out there on the field playing the game. It's not the same when you're out there in the middle of it. You say, well, didn't he see that fellow over there was wide open? There's nobody around him. He could have given that guy the ball. Well, no, maybe he couldn't see that. There were five guys that weighed 320 pounds each that were 7 feet tall coming at him. He couldn't see that guy over there, no. But we do that to each other sometimes. It's something that we have to be aware of. It's so easy to do. Then we want to turn to chapter 13. Job, again, after he's cut back at his friends to try to let them know that he's not just going to give up and crumble here, he then, in chapter 13, in verse 15 and 16, we see the amazing faith and the determination and the level of commitment that Job has. I wonder, as I read through the book of Job, if I faced anything even remotely similar to what he faced, if I'd be able to stand up like he did. It's amazing, as he says here in verse 15, though he slay area. Job again tries to tell his friends, look, I know where I stand with God. I know I've done right, and even if he kills me, I'll still trust him because he's the one that's going to save me in the end. Because he knows I'm not a hypocrite. A hypocrite can't stand before God. Never can. Never has, never will. And so Job makes it clear. I'm preparing myself. He said, I'm maintaining my ways before him. I'm keeping it up. I'm going to continue to do what is right. Chapter 14 then. Chapter 14, we find one of those little jewels that I referred to. There are a lot of people who have taught and many that believe and teach to this day that those living in the Old Testament times didn't believe in an afterlife, that they didn't believe in a resurrection. But Job, on at least two occasions that we're going to see tonight, proved them wrong. He did believe that there was a resurrection. Notice what he does say here in chapter 14, beginning in verse 10. He says, but man dieth and wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he? As the waters fail from the sea, and the flood decays and dries up, so man lieth down and riseth not till the heavens be no more. They shall not awake nor be raised out of their sleep. Now, some would say, well, that makes it sound like, it sounds like he doesn't believe in a resurrection at all. No. He's actually proclaiming the resurrection. He says, yes, men die. We lie down and we don't rise back up. And notice what he says. Till the heavens be no more. We know what's going to happen in the last day. The heavens and the earth will pass away and they shall be no more. And at that time, yes, the dead shall rise again. But Job says, until that time, we know, you know, we die. We're not going to just get up tomorrow or next week. But not until the heavens are no more. That's when the resurrection is going to be. We're going to see another passage after a while that shows even more clearly that Job believed in a resurrection. And he believed that it would be a bodily resurrection, if we can call it that. Is what we don't know what kind of body we'll have, but we do know that the resurrection will be a bodily work, and he's going to deal with that later on. And remember, while God may not have agreed with everything that Job's friend said, at the end he says, Job has not spoken anything amiss concerning me. So everything that Job says, we can take to be as inspired by God. God approves of what Job said. And we're going to see some more of it in a little while. But we have to choose carefully what we take from what his friends say. Because some of them say some things, as the one a moment ago, as Zophar said, that Job was a liar. Well, we know better than that. We know that the whole reason Job's going through this is because God did believe he was a perfect and upright man in his generation. He believed he was a righteous man. That's the whole reason. It wasn't because he had done wickedness. And so Zophar was incorrect in that assessment of Job. Look to chapter 15 then. And here we see some of the confusion that some of his friends seem to have had. Eliphaz here now. Back to Eliphaz again. The first of his friends just spoke and is speaking again. We're in what's often referred to as the second round of speeches now. That's kind of a common debate technique. One speaks and the other responds, and then the other speaks and the other responds, and you follow that pattern. And so and now they've gone all the way around, all the friends have had a chance to talk, and Job's had his chance to respond, and now they're starting over again. So if we look at chapter 15, down to verse 14. He says, what is man that he should be clean? And he which is born of a woman, that he should be righteous? Behold, he putteth no trust in his saints. Yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. How much more abominable and filthy is man which drinketh iniquity like water? Now on the surface, what Elijah says here may seem to be true. And in some respects, it may have some elements of accuracy to it. Certainly, mankind on his own can never be righteous. And under the law that they were dealing with age before the law of Moses, there was no way for them to have their sins dismissed and forgotten about and carried away as we have under Jesus' law. But in fact, we know that now, under the law of Christ, we can be righteous. We can be acceptable to God. And for him to say that he doesn't trust his saints, some would say that the saints are his holy ones in reference to the angels, that even the angels aren't clean in his sight. But whether it's saints or angels or holy ones, whatever you want to say there, it's not true that he doesn't put trust in them. In fact, we see that this very book is an evidence of just how much trust God does put in his saints. Look how much trust he put in Job. He trusted that Job would be strong enough to stand firm despite all of these things. God puts a great deal of trust in us. He has entrusted us with the most precious of things that there is, the gospel of Christ. Oh yes, he puts his trust in his saints, there's no doubt about it. So Eliphaz is wrong about that. And certainly to say, but what is man that he should be clean? Well, certainly, we know we can never be clean on our own. But that's the beauty of the difference in the time that we live now. With Christ, we can be clean. We can be righteous in God's sight. His blood has covered our sins, and God sees them no more. Then we come to chapter 16. And again, in chapter 16, Job turns the tables on them. You might, we're going to look at beginning in verse 2 here. He says, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. You know, when somebody's going through a hard time, it ought to be our desire to go and to comfort them as much as possible. But he said, you're miserable comforters. You're not doing a very good job of it. And he goes on to say, shall vain words have an end? Or for what emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? I also could speak as ye do if your souls were in my soul's stead. I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. So Job says, you know, it's easy for you to sit over there and condemn me, but if I were in your place, I'd be doing what I could to help. You guys are doing a miserable job of being good, of being friends here. You might put a cross-reference from that section, verses 2 through 5 in chapter 16, back to verses 2 through 5 in chapter 13. He says some of the same kinds of things there. He says, what ye know, the same do I know also. I am not inferior to you. So sometimes we do have a tendency to put somebody down when they're going through a hard time. Somebody's out of work, and we may accuse them of being lazy and not wanting to work. But certainly there are some people who fit that description, but not everybody who doesn't have a job does. So be careful about making assumptions about people. All of us can lose our job at any time. It's not guaranteed us. And he goes on to say, surely I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God, but ye are forgers of lies. You are all physicians of no value. You ever gone to one of those doctors? A doctor of no value? Sometimes there's some of those out there. He says, that's what these friends were. He says, oh, that you would altogether hold your peace, and it should be your wisdom. He said, I'd appreciate your wisdom a lot more if you're just quiet. Just be quiet, and I'd appreciate that. I'd be more wise than the things you're saying to me now. And so, here are two different cases. He turns it back on him and he says, you know, you are not doing what you ought to be doing. And so he tries to turn things about against them. In chapter 17, he makes several things known, but particularly in verse 9. He says, the righteous also shall hold on his way, and he that hath clean hands shall be stronger and stronger. Job he's starting to regain a little bit of his confidence. He's starting to think, you know, I've reached the bottom, I can't get any worse, maybe things are going to start getting better. He says, you know, the righteous may hold on to his way, and he's going to get stronger and stronger. He, Job was to the point of despair and wishing that God would just let him die because he was in that bad of shape. Well, now he's turned things around. He's starting to look up again. He's starting to think, well, things maybe have gotten as bad as they can get. Maybe there's no place to go but up. He says, the tree that has clean hands shall be stronger and stronger. But he still has some sad thoughts. He knows things aren't better yet, but he starts to see a little bit of his hope peeking through. His faith in God has remained strong through to this point, and now he hopes that the worst of it is behind him. Maybe things will get better from this point on. Then chapter 18, Bildad gets his second chance to speak. And he says some things that are things certainly that you can't argue with, not particularly. You might see cases that it doesn't seem to be right, but for the most part what he says isn't very wrong at any rate. In verses 5 and following, we'll just read the first couple of verses, but he continues on through the end of the chapter. He says in verse 5, "Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out, and the spark of his fire shall not shine. The light shall be dark in his tabernacle," or his tent, in other words, "and his candle shall be put out with him." Well, we know that's the case. We know that God is going to destroy the wicked. It sometimes doesn't seem like he gets around to it as quickly as we'd like for him to. But that's the way God works. He's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. That's who he is. But he's not going to put their light out that fast. But he goes on through the rest of the chapter, the other 15 verses or so, to talk about what's going to happen to those wicked people. And we see many things in there that are going to happen to the wicked people, how their net is going to catch them in their own snare, and they're going to be terrors that will make them afraid, and all of these things. He goes on down through the chapter talking about these things that happen to the wicked. If nothing else, it should be a warning to us not to be one of those wicked folks. Because the way he describes some of those things that he says are going to happen to them are certainly not things that anyone would desire. Then we come to chapter 19. Chapter 19 and verse 3, there's an indication here. Perhaps it's just a figure of speech that Job uses here. But if he is being particularly accurate in his use of numbers, then there's a lot to this encounter that isn't shared with us in the Bible. He says in verse 3, "These 10 times have you reproached me. You're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me." Now maybe that he's just using a figure of speech, like we might say, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. Or I've told you 1,000,000 times, not to exaggerate. My dad used to say that all the time. I've told you 1,000,000 times, not to exaggerate. Well, I don't think he's told me 1,000,000 times, not to exaggerate. He's told me a bunch of times, but I doubt it's been 1,000,000. And so sometimes we use numbers just kind of generically like that. And maybe that's what Job's doing here. But if he does really mean that they have said 10 times to him a particular thing, then we don't have recorded all of their arguments and all of their discussion. We just have a portion of it, the portion that God saw was fit for us to have. But while we're in chapter 19, that's just a little sidelight note there. While we're in chapter 19, we want to look at the other passage where Job talks about the resurrection. Down in verse 25. Most would agree that this passage refers to Jesus. Some have argued that he's talking about a physical person that was alive at that time. But I think the indication here seems to be that he's referring to Jesus. He says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives." So we sing that song. "I know that my Redeemer lives and ever prays for me." He says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth." Job's prophesying the coming of Christ. He knew that Jesus, not in the form of Jesus, but the Word, the Son of God, he knew he was alive, and he knew that at the latter time he was going to stand on the earth.
He says, after I die and my body decays, I'm still going to get to see God in my flesh, in my body, in other words, he says, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. You let us know right there that the people, even back as far back possibly as Abraham or further, believed in the resurrection. Do you remember what the Hebrew writer says about Abraham when he offered Isaac up? He offered Isaac up and was prepared to kill Isaac, believing that God could raise him from the dead. Abraham believed in the resurrection. He believed in the power of God, and Job does too. You see, Jesus was very right when he told the Sadducees, "You do greatly err, not knowing the power of God or the Scriptures." There are several Scriptures in the Old Testament that should have been enough for those Sadducees to understand that there was going to be a resurrection. But they were just too blind to see them. And Jesus said that you greatly err. Not just they made a little mistake, they greatly err because of that. But we see here, after our body is destroyed, we're going to be resurrected. He says, I'm going to see God in my flesh. It's going to be a different body, because this one's already decaying, but it's going to be some kind of a body. It's going to be our body. It's going to be us. We don't know what it's going to be like, but we're going to have it'll be a heavenly body, but we're going to have a body. And there's, some people that, we're just going to be, little wisps of gas floating around somewhere, or, just energy signals or something. No, it's going to be a bodily resurrection. We're going to rise from the dead. And Job says as much. He believes his own eyes. He's going to have eyes in this body. He's going to see God with his own eyes. Not going to sense him with electrical currents or something like that, like some of the New Age foolishness that's going on nowadays. Sure, I'm going to have eyes. I'm going to be able to see God. Now, that's going to be something, because we've never been able to see God before. But after the resurrection, we're going to be able to see God. We're going to have some special eyes to be able to see God. They're going to be different than these eyes, because these eyes that we have now can't see God. But God's going to make us some eyes so that we can see Him. Here we come to chapter 20. Chapter 20 and verse 4. Zophar speaks again. He says, "Knowest thou not this of old, since man was placed upon the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite but for a moment." Now, nobody's right in that. It might not be according to our times just for a moment. We might say, well, they live their whole life that way. But in God's scheme of things, and in light of eternity, it is but for just a moment. It's a short time. See, the mistake Zophar makes is that he is directing these comments toward Job. He's saying Job's a hypocrite. He's saying Job's wicked. He says, don't you know you're gonna get it? you better turn around and do right. Tell God you're sorry for all these bad things you've done, and quit pretending that you haven't done them. But he directs that statement at the wrong person. But he is correct in what he says about the wicked. Then chapter 21 and verse number 3. We want to get through 22, and then we'll quit on 22. Job, he kept his sense of humor through all of this. And that's one thing that can make all the difference. Being able to keep a good attitude of being able to laugh at things, being able to be upbeat about things. But you just see, you have to imagine him speaking these words to these friends, and the condition. Here's Job, sores all over his body, sitting in ashes, hurting so bad he's scraping himself, and yet some of these things, we've seen some of them already, where he says, oh, but doubtless you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. And some of these things, and here he says, suffer me that I may speak. And after that I have spoken, knock on. Just don't keep mocking me, but just let me finish saying this a little bit, then you can go back to mocking me, making fun of me. He's still keeping, he may not be enjoying himself, but he's trying to keep a good attitude. And it's not an easy thing to do when doing it to his face and not behind his back, but he said, just let me speak this a little bit, and then after that you can go on and go back to mocking me some more. Then in chapter 22, we'll finish with this one. Here again, one of those little things that would seem to be overlooked sometimes, perhaps, and one that I had overlooked in the past. Listening to this, the book being read on CD, traveling down the road, and this verse just caught my attention for the first time. I'd never noticed it before, not that I've spent a great deal of time studying the book of Job, but I had read it several times before, and I just never noticed that. This verse in chapter 22 lets us know a little bit about the date of Job. I had thought at one time that perhaps Job was even written before the flood, but this passage in chapter 22 lets me know that that's not the case. It was sometime after the flood. Notice what he says, beginning in verse 15. Hast thou marked the old way which wicked men have trodden, which were cut down out of time, whose foundation was overflown with a flood? I don't think there's any doubt that Eliphaz has to be making reference to the flood in which the wicked were destroyed by God in the time of Noah. And for him to make reference to that being in old time, that means it must have already happened. And so these events have to be taking place sometime on this side of the flood. But some of that little thing, you see how just one little verse tucked in there among 42 chapters that lets us know a little bit about when these events took place. And that's the way a lot of things are. We read it over and we miss it. We don't see it. We read it again and we don't see it. And sometimes several hundred times we may have read a particular verse before it jumps out at us exactly what's being said in that verse. But I think to refer to those wicked men whose foundation was overflowing with the flood, without doubt. And to whether that is should be a flood or the flood, I don't know. The Hebrew, they translated it a flood, but there is some debate about when to use a and when to use the in some of these. They don't have, our language either is a or it's the, but in the Hebrew language, there's not a word for it. So they have to try to decide from the context which to put in there. They put a flood here, but even if it is a flood, there's a great likelihood that he's referring to the flood of Noah. We see Job going through troubles like most of us can never imagine, and being turned on. Even when we do go through troubles, at least most of the time, we do have somebody that wants to be a comfort to us. Job was all alone. No one, it seemed, was on his side. Yet he remained firm. He remained strong. Job will be one of the people who will be the standard that shows how righteous or how wicked we are. Because God knows what mankind is capable of. He knows what Job did. He knows that we too can endure. When we read about what Job went through and he kept his faith, and yet sometimes when we see the petty little things that cause us to doubt, why do we doubt over such little things? Job didn't doubt. He says, even if he kills me, I'll still trust him. He says, I know my Redeemer lives. He said, he's my salvation. Job's faith should be an example to us. We talk about Job's patience all the time. His faith, too, should be a great example to us. If you're here this evening, you haven't each responded to the invitation for any reason, we ask that you do so as we stand and have a seat.